Hello, dear internet strangers. Today is August 31st, and we are talking in an obscurity. Companion podcast to Writing in Obscurity. Today we are talking about A Crime in the Family by Sasha Batyani, and I'm joined with my co-host,
Steve Kubitz.
So how are you feeling today, Steve?
I feel good, man. I feel like lately we've had a lot of kind of heavy books, so I'm excited hopefully getting some a little lighter. Just to jog my memory, what's this book about again?
The Holocaust.
Fuck.
World War II as well, I mean. Also, you know, very sad, but...
You know, I come here thinking I'm having a good time, talk about maybe a book about space viruses. But no, okay.
We're just gonna...
I just keep getting sadder. What's our next book about? it's the Encyclopedia of Dead Dogs.
Okay. Let's launch into what we love about this book. I know. Let's talk about what we loved about the Holocaust book.
So, for me... Honestly, I actually did really enjoy this book. It was my pick. Yeah. So, I actually generally love this book. It's a very, like, poignant sort of look at sort of familial trauma and sort of that guilt that can come along with it. And the thing I really liked about this book, obviously, because the guy that wrote it, it's his family. So the book felt very personal. Mm-hmm. You could really, like, hear the torment in sort of his words. You could really pick up on how sad he felt and just how just guilty he felt and sort of how I would argue disgusted he felt.
I really like the smaller scope to this book, because what I feel like Batyani did in this is, like, most books about World War II are, they're big in scope and they talk about numbers and they talk about the titans and the tyrants of the day, whereas this is more focused on actual people and individuals who live through this, and this all takes place in Hungary, and it, like, my favorite part of this book is he includes the direct journal entries of his grandmother and this Jewish woman Agnes, who was very close to the family, and, like, I love those sections a lot. I don't know how did you feel about those?
Those were the most powerful sort of poignant parts of the story for me, is because for those that don't know, by the, you know, my name's Steve Kubitz, I'm Jewish, so get your hate ready. So I have a lot of family that endured this time, survived this time. I have a lot of family that didn't survive this time. So getting to sort of hear about, when people think diaries, Holocaust, we know what book people think of.
Diary Anne Frank.
But, you know, there are plenty of other people that kept diaries. She doesn't have the market cornered on diaries.
I mean, she did die at the end of it. Yeah. Let's be aggressive against Anne.
Yeah. I'm not. You know, I love Anne Frank. You know, she's great. But, like, so having sort of other points of view of the time from sort of an older character, you know, she wasn't old at the time, but, I mean, she was older. And so it felt very interesting to sort of look at, not only from the perspective of a Jewish person, but the perspective of someone that was kind of in power of Jewish people a little bit. I mean, you know, his family was very old world, like, not diplomats, but old world, kind of that.
So they were minor
aristocrats. Yeah, they were kind of aristocrats.
I don't want to get too off topic here, but it occurs to me, I should have mentioned spoilers about Anne Frank there, that she dies at the end of the Diary of Anne Frank. But, like, back on topic, I admire how hard of a book this had to have been to write for him. Because it does not put the Batyanis in a good light. He talks, the big event of this book is his great aunt Margaret had hosted a party for Nazis. And part of this big party was they gathered up a whole bunch of Jews. And they shot them.
As one does at parties, you know. I personally give out little tiny bottles of alcohol in my parties. But, you know, different times, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, shooting Jews is not a great... I think we can all agree, unless you're terrible, that you shouldn't shoot Jews at your parties. And the...
Or just in general.
Not just at parties. You shouldn't murder anybody. Everybody's a person. And there's a sort of mystery whether or not she was directly involved in that part. but he doesn't really defend her in it. He doesn't make her into, she was just doing what she needed to do to survive. No, she was evil. And he makes that clear, that she was stone cold evil, lived her life after these events, and she was just fine. She raised horses, and she was a great equestrian. And nobody ever, at no point was she like torn up about the fact that she, at this party, they killed like 180?
Yeah, I think it was like 180 people, 190 people.
Yeah.
It was under 200, but it was, you know.
And this is just what they did in the course of the party. And like, what do you even do whenever you find that out about your family? Is like, oh yeah, she once hosted a party, and part of that party was murdering a whole bunch of people.
That's, I think, what makes this book powerful in a lot of ways, is I think every family has skeletons in their closet. Granted, these are some big skeletons. You know, this is far different than, oh, you know, your uncle got a DUI in 1975. You know, this would be like if your uncle, like, yeah, he ran over a homeless guy and just kept driving, and then went back and ran over another homeless guy and kept driving. Like
he found out he liked it.
But yeah, he got a taste for it. Like, so this is like a real big skeleton in the closet for the family. And I think that, you know, Sasha, as a writer, it really does a good job of sort of, imagine if you grew up your entire life thinking one way, and, you know, you kind of know what happened during those times. You know, I think of this one Family Guy joke that I don't know what where they're at, what the context is, but it's like, oh, they're in Germany, and they're like, why do you have nothing in here from 1939 to 1945? We're on vacation. No, you weren't. That's when World War II started. No, we're on vacation. Ask anyone. Poland was there. And like, so imagine if, you know, you know, it's real easy to sort of deny that, like, it sort of remove yourself from the context, especially after the war was over. You could kind of, they went to a different country, they settled somewhere else. So imagine you're a kid, this kid, you know, kid, he's an adult now, but learning this in adulthood, that your family not only was on the side of the Nazis, but kind of an active and happy participant in what the Nazis were doing.
Well, part of his family. Margaret was a huge Nazi sympathizer. If you throw a party for Nazis, you're a Nazi, in my opinion. The rest of his family, they were just cowards. Like, and that doesn't excuse them. Why there are two different competing journal entries is, one is from Sasha Batyani's grandmother's perspective, and how after the war was lost, the Red Army came in and destroyed her world. But before that happened, she talks about how her friend Agnes, and we get to see her journal entries. I love that, because I love those journal entries. She talks about how Agnes's parents worked at their property as laborers during this time, and they tried to leave, and his grandmother's father just stood by as a Nazi shot them. And that was that's an act level of cowardice that it's not the same as hosting a party for Nazis, but it's still horrible.
It's on the spectrum of that. I think for, like, you know, to the other point, you know, this is the thing we like about this book. It really leans in to the banality of evil.
Yeah.
Because when we think of, like, Nazis, or we think of Nazi sympathizers, you know, maybe in America in 2021, there's definitely Nazis are definitely in the news. But when we think of that, especially given the time frame, we think of the full goose-stepping uniform, armband. That's what we think of. You know, and, you know, for the most part, this book does a really good job of pointing out how many sort of plain clothes Nazis there kind of were, in the sense that they weren't actively in the military. Nazis were a very particular branch of the German military, but they absolutely were, at least part of his family, very happy to entertain them, happy to sort of stay in their good graces, and part of being in those good graces was massacres.
Yeah, I mean, there, no matter what level you are, whether you're actively participating or you're just standing by, you're still collaborating. But I want to move on to our what we didn't love about this book, and we had talked about this before. The major thing that he does that kind of annoys me, where he has these novelistic sort of imaginings that he enters into the narrative of this book, where the source material doesn't really specify, because he's delving into these journals of his grandmother and of this Jewish woman, and he's talking about family events before he was born, and he's sort of like he imagines the tone how people used, and he reimagines scenes, and I felt like that really cheapened the story, that whenever he did these sort of like navel gazing, like it could have happened this way or it could have happened that way. I think that the source material in of itself, it told a story that was profound enough, and that him doing this reimagining of it, or how it could have been this way, it kind of cheapens it.
So that's exactly, you know, I don't want to harp on this too much, because that was my sort of first negative about this book, was I didn't really enjoy the fictionalized versions of events. You know, I think that by doing that, I think that you not only cheapen the gut punch that is this sort of the facts of what happened, I think you accidentally, and I'm not trying to, you know, I don't think he did it, he definitely didn't do it on purpose, for sure. You accidentally give credence to some people that like to deny that this happened.
Mm-hmm.
Because, oh, if this part's made up, this whole thing can be made up. How do you know this all wasn't made up?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't even think about that the first time I read through this, and whenever I wrote my original review. That's a great point, is where, because people who want to, like, push this aside like it never happened, they'll jump on anything. If they see any sort of discrepancy, they're like, see, it can't be sure, so it's all fake.
Yeah, it's like the Holocaust denier of like, interesting, you said 6 million Jews died in the Holocaust, yet I see here it was only 5,993,009. Yeah, that's interesting. So that's not 6 million, that's actually 7 less than 6 million. So that's all, it's all made up.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that, like, that's such a thing you don't want to give, you don't give any chance that you're potentially being accused of embellishing or creating a narrative, that you're, just tell the story for what it is and let the sort of stuff speak for itself.
Yeah, I agree with that a lot. Another thing that I don't know how to feel about this. It's not that I dislike this, it's just I don't know how to feel about it one way or the other, is there's a lot of this book that's devoted to him, Sasha, speaking to his therapist about this whole event, and like there's a lot of the talk in this book is his therapy sessions, and that feels like a very personal thing to me. I didn't dislike it, but I didn't understand why he would just share this with strangers. And like personally, I find speaking to a psychiatrist, that's something you share with family and close friends. So it was a little weird about that.
See, I think overall, I wouldn't say I liked it. I wouldn't say, but you know, I wouldn't say I hated it. But I do find that I don't mind. I think that it's okay being comfortable enough to share that you're in therapy. Especially what I think it does is I think it gives you a context of the weight he felt and the guilt he felt learning this about his family. Because so often, and we struggle with this in America a ton, we don't have that long of history in terms of global history, but we struggle with the idea of how do you reckon what your ancestors did, your sort of your direct line of family. Because you think about the example we have here are families of like slave owners.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do you reckon learning that you built your fortune, your family built their fortune in slavery? Do you say, I had nothing to do with it, I wasn't even alive, it's 150 years before I was born, or this was, you know, 50 years before I was born?
Or do you recognize you're a beneficiary of
that? Do you recognize that, and then how does it make you feel? I think in this case, there, you can react however you want to react. I'm not telling you that you have to feel guilty and go to therapy. But in his case, I think it was good to show you sort of what this did and sort of the weight of it.
I did consider, whenever I was writing my initial review of this book, that maybe it was sort of a ripple effect that he wanted to show, is that this shame transcended generational barriers. That, like, it affected him so strongly that he had to seek therapy. And the reason that he added this therapy stuff to the book is to show that. And I considered that. It's just that, like, it seems a very personal thing. And it's not the first thing if I were writing this, it wouldn't occur to me.
Yeah, I think that's, you know, it's not really a bad or a good thing. It's just sort of a thing, mm-hmm. I think, overall. That's sort of how I looked at it. You know, I didn't hate it. I didn't like it. I thought it gave him some interesting context. It gave the writer, not only as a writer, but as a character in the story, a little bit of context.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. Another thing I didn't really love about this, and this is just kind of my own bias, is that in any sort of biography situation, I like my biographer to have distance from his story. I like that objectivity where he is not a character in his own biography. And that's obviously impossible in this, because this is his family. Like, so it'd be weird if he wrote all of this about his family and didn't include anything about him himself in it. But at the same time, like, it's just my preferences. I prefer a distance between my biographer and the actual biography.
Yeah, I get that. I think that it's tough when I think there you feel like you have a story to tell. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so it does. So this is interesting because it's not a biographer doing like a biography of, like, it's not like Abe Lincoln's son doing a biography of Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah.
This is more of a sort of a memoir, if you will, of this family and sort of their role in this sort of huge global event and sort of what that did to the current generation of that family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's a way to look at it. Not so much that it's a biography of, like, these events. Because it's not really a biography. It's not about any one person or any, you know, one thing. It's sort of about family in general. Which I guess you can do a biography of a family, but I think that for me, why I think it's a little bit, I'm more okay with him not having this, you know, the distance and, like, the space, is because I think it's his story as much as it is their story.
Yeah, I mean, that leads to another thing where, like, I think you had said this whenever we were reading this, where the focus on this is a little hard.
That's sort of my third dislike, or my other dislike, is that I found this story very disjointed. I find that it bounces around a lot, and it doesn't stay focused on sort of what it is. Because it could be, oh, is it a story about his grandmother and his aunt, his great-aunt's sort of role in this horrible massacre? Or is it about how he deals with it? Or is it about his relationship with his father and sort of how his father chose to deal with the sort of family shame? There's a lot of things that this story could be about, but instead you don't really get a focus on either one of them.
Yeah, to me it feels like he's telling many different stories, where he's telling the story of these journal entries his grandmother kept and that Agnes kept, and then he's telling the story about him in therapy, and then he's telling the story about him meeting Agnes's daughters and her as an old woman, and sort of apologizing for his family's role in it, and they, like, a really sad thing is he reveals that his grandmother's parent and father specifically was there when Agnes's parents were gunned down by Nazis. He didn't do anything, and, like, so there are just so many different stories that he's telling, and, like, the focus is a little off. But, like, I find myself playing devil's advocate with the kind of guilt that this is would be all-encompassing. And the perspective is so broad that how do you leave any of it out?
You really can't. I think that's actually, it's funny. The thing I don't like about this book is how disjointed it feels, but the thing I overall enjoy about it is how you can't look at guilt, especially generational guilt, in any kind of, like, a linear way. I did this, so now I feel bad. That's a very, like, that's guilt, for sure. But this sort of generational guilt is very much, he had nothing to do, you know, Sasha as a person had nothing to do with what his family did. Mm-hmm. We can't. You can't. You know, you can't be arrested for a murder that your great grandfather did.
Yeah.
But you absolutely, upon learning about it, are allowed to feel anything how you choose to feel, how you choose to react to it. He definitely wore it. And it causes him a great deal of pain. I think that's probably why the story is so disjointed, is he wants to really put his family's guilt and shame and his own guilt and shame into the sort of ether of the world. And I think that as a result of that, it comes off as very like, I feel bad for this, I feel bad for this, but here's, let me explain to you why I feel bad for this and why I make this. Let me make sense of this a little bit. So it comes off as very like sporadic. In certain, because it's trying to fit a lot of like what he feels guilty about and what he feels shame about into this short, this book's only, it's not that long of a book, but he found a way to pack a lot of like punches in it.
Yeah, I think that just occurred to me in this moment is that it feels like he couldn't not talk about this because there's this section that didn't really occur to me, like I didn't really understand it until this moment, now that I'm thinking about it, where he's talking to these prostitutes, really. They have nothing to do with the rest of the story, and he just tells them about what he's been working on, and like he can't not talk about it. It's one of these things where like the shame of this is so consuming that like just bleeds all over these random people that he just meets. And, like, he tells the story of it.
Yeah, I think that's sort of what makes it such a powerful sort of story. It makes you feel a lot of sympathy for him. Because I know what it's like to sort of... You ever had a moment where you're having just a rough day or you're having a rough decade and someone asks you, hey, how's it going? And you know it's just a pleasantry, but you then dive into it. Or you've ever been into a, like a store, and you ask someone, how's it going? And they start telling you, even though you're really just being polite, and it's like you sort of sit there and go, okay, this person's either needs a hug or a bottle of bourbon. I'm not sure which one.
That's why I avoid that.
Yeah.
I always just say, good day.
Yeah, so like, I think that's sort of what, that's funny you say that, because I didn't even think of that, the scene where he talks to the two sex workers. That imagine, I'd love to see their perspective on this. They're just like bright eyed, like, well, that's nice. Sorry your family did that, champ. Like,
yeah, like it has to be because I mean, they lived in, I think they was in Hungary at the time, so they lived there, but like it was not part of their lives. I mean, but to bring back it to the point of shame and like to get to our parting thoughts of this, I think that the overall theme of this book is cowardice and how Aunt Margaret, as evil as she was, she isn't a coward. She loved Nazis and like she loved being who she was. But really, the thing that we find, I think that we as a society find most objectionable are the people that just kind of stand by. Because at least the evil people are who they are. It's the cowards that, like, his great-grandfather would just watch these people that he knew and he liked and he employed and they were his neighbors just get gunned down in front of him. And he didn't do anything about it other than he then covered it up. I mean, that's... There's something more disappointing about that.
So I think that, like... For my parting thoughts would be, in a similar vein, sort of how the banality of evil, we talked about a little bit in earlier, but that's kind of, this is my overarching theme of the book, is that, you know, when a person, you invite a vampire into your house and they bite you and kill you. You invite a vampire into your house.
Mm-hmm.
That's on you, you know. If your neighbor goes, oh, this is my friend Tim, you can invite him in. And so it's an active role in it. But if you are just out in the world and someone you're being chased by a vampire, see someone being chased by a vampire, and then they throw you into the path of it, that's a little... maybe they're doing what they could to survive, but it's a different level of just... You're going to judge them a little harsher than the vampire is doing his thing. And the Nazis were just doing the Nazi things. So that doesn't excuse their behavior, and they're disgusting, and they're deplorable, and every person that had anything to do with the Nazi Party, you know, got kind of what they deserved at the end of it. You know, they either got hanged or they started working at NASA.
Well, I mean, some of them knew a lot about rockets.
Yeah.
But, like, I think that is one of those things where it can't be said enough, is that the scariest thing about people, like just average, ordinary people, is the things that they could just abide. They could just, if they're not part of the out group, as the Jews were during World War II, it's amazing what they don't see. Like, and how, well, what was I going to do? I don't want to get shot in the head. Yeah, but like, your not doing anything led to millions of people going to gas chambers.
Because there's a lot of people were.
And like, and that's not to say that there weren't people who resisted and did the noble thing. But the saddest thing about us as a species is that that noble impulse in us is kind of rare. Most people are just going to go watch where the wind is blowing, and that's where they're going.
Yeah, I think what makes this such a kind of heartbreaking thing to think about is, so America recently, we've had a reckoning with this a little bit, where especially in the, say, the 5 or 6, maybe 10 years after 9/11, with people giving sort of distrust to Muslims and anyone brown, basically, unfortunately. Like, I think back, you know, how many Hindus got accosted for no reason just because they looked brown. Mm-hmm. But, you know, but for the most part, it's people that, what makes World War II and the Holocaust so particularly heartbreaking, it wasn't just the Nazis building war machines and ovens and things like that and doing their evil things. It's the idea that you, as a person, could be living in this town throughout the 1930s. Every day you come out and you go to work and you see your neighbor, you wave to him, and it's a nice little moment. You don't really, you're not friends, but you just see him, you wave him.
They're in your life. Yeah.
And then one day, someone comes and tells you that your neighbor is Jewish, it's illegal, he's now, please report him. And you see him getting taken away, and he's like, please help me, help, and you don't. This person you've had interactions with, maybe you've shared meals with him, maybe you've, whatever, you know, but the idea that you can just sort of look away and just knowing in your gut, this dude's dying. This is it. This is the end for this person. And I'm able to just look away. And I find that to be the most horrifying thing, because of how many people just looked away.
Well, I think that it's short-sighted, because there was another book that is called Rosewater Now, but like, it had a great title of Then They Came For Me. And that kind of reference, it's not about Nazi Germany, but like, it kind of has that same feel where, to think that they won't eventually come for you. That's where that famous, that famous thing where, like, they came for the Jews and I said nothing, and then they came for the Gypsies and I said nothing, and then they came for, and I'm paraphrasing, of course, but like, people will find smaller and smaller and smaller groups, and the idea that you will never be on the out group if you can't have, like, muster that level of empathy. Like, I don't know how to explain it to you. It's just one of those things where, like, of course, eventually somebody, if they come to power, they might just kill you because you have green eyes, blue eyes, brown eyes, whatever. People can kill people over stupid things and just justify it. And you need to... I personally feel that at the end of the day, you need to stand up for your fellow creature, because all life is worth living.
Yeah, I think that's sort of the most pointy way to sort of end this a little bit. It's just, so much of this book really makes you think of what you would do in any, like, extreme scenario. And we all like to picture ourselves as the hero.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, the fortunate reality is most of us would be the great-grandfather. Just when tested, you fail that test. And you do anything you can to save your own skin, and knowing, I'm not going to go down. They're dead. I have nothing I can do. I'm just going to look away. I'm not a cow. I'm just surviving. And you can tell yourself that all you want. And it's probably true. There's probably an element of truth that you just survived.
Mm-hmm.
But you didn't do, you know, you survived. But did you really, survival, did your soul survive?
Survival at what cost?
Like,
because clearly there was a generational thing that ripples through, because he's going to therapy still. And what is the next generation like after that? Shame carries over. And we've talked in the past, in our lives, about how courage is a skill. And it takes practice. And you fail. And just because you're a coward today doesn't mean you're a coward tomorrow. But I think that's one of the big values of a book like this, is that you get that hypothetical practice of, think about what it did to his family. Because his daughter was ashamed, and she was burning her journals. His grandson and his great-grandson are both clearly messed up about all of this. So, yeah, he survived in that moment. But what did it cost the rest of the family?
Pretty much their entire... Honestly, the family's soul is forever muddied.
Yeah.
And like, that's just an unfortunate reality of it. And that's a reckoning that family's going to have to deal with probably forever. And there's a lot of families like that I imagine are dealing with probably similar, if not identical, stories of shame and guilt and being weak and being a coward. Because... Unfortunately, the unfortunate reality is cowards tend to live longer.
Yeah, that's true. I think that's where we're going to leave you on that happy note. Cowards live longer.
They do, fortunately.
So hopefully you enjoyed our talk today, and we'll see you next month.